It's now time for the Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines, energy columnist and owner of the Word Merchant. Being joined now by Professor Stephen Hines. Now, I got to track where he's at these days because, let's see, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then I want to say Oshkosh, Wisconsin was, I think, one of the last time we talked to him. And now I think he's down in Maryland down there trying to fight with the fat cats down in Washington, D.C. Hey, what's going on, Professor Hines?
Well, I'm in Baltimore, and the annual NARUC meeting is going on right now, and the NARUC stands for National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. So all 50 states are here, their staffs and the commissioners and other interested parties like myself. And I think this is really our first meeting where the commissioners didn't have to worry about the Clean Power Plan and are now back to doing what's called cooperative federalism, which is where the states work carefully with the federal government, but the states are in charge of their own utility questions and environments, et cetera, et cetera. About 1,500 people are here, Jason.
So when I hear the term federalism and where the corporations and the companies are working with the states, I'm of course thinking that goes into the world of politics right away. And is that getting responded well, bad? What's the overall theme of the federalism when it comes to oil and gas?
It is that it was back in the 1930s during the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, and electricity was really just starting to make a major impact in the United States. And it was during that time that they devised the notion of having states deal with their own electricity, energy, pipeline, environmental issues, but yet with some small guidance from Washington. But it was pretty much of a hands off by the federal government. So name cooperative federalism, I suppose it just helped describe what this arrangement was. And up until a couple of years ago, we've been doing fine. Your state, North Dakota, my state, Wisconsin. The commissions have been doing a really good job in all senses of the word. They have a very difficult job. They have to deal with politics. They have to deal with economic development for their state and also the state's environment. So when the EPA tried to take power away from the states, it really put everything in limbo. In fact, we couldn't tell whether the commissioners were going to just be second-class citizens and that all decisions about the grid and power plants and all were going to be made in Washington, which, as you know, is kind of a recipe for disaster. If you want to think about the national parks, you can see how well the federal government has taken care of the national parks. Actually, it's one of the big embarrassments. Even though it's a great idea, the national parks, it was never really funded until the early 20th century. And there's so much ignored footage and acreage of federal property, especially out west of the Mississippi in your part of the world. And they just the federal government has just never bothered to really do anything other than let it grow, which is one of the reasons why you hear about a lot of the fires out in the west, because they haven't allowed states and cities to trim the trees and get rid of the shrubbery and all of the dead stuff that really helps start a massive fire.
Steve, let me jump in for a minute here, because because what you brought up is something that we've looked at exploring this topic, and we're not sure how to tackle it because there's so much emotion involved, which is the federal parks. Listen, oil and gas, from my understanding, from what I've seen, what I've heard, and what I've historically seen, I guess, what evidence there is, They do a pretty good job of reclamation. They do a good job of the economic development. They do a good job of the oversight, which I think is interesting. You know, you talk about the trees trimming back and everything else. We wanted to do a story or a feature on looking at how the parks and oil and gas can work closer together, actually, because of how responsible really drilling has gotten in these, in the size of the footprint of the pads and how they're able to do a lot of the horizontal drilling. It's not damaging the surface. Are these conversations happening out there?
Well, you know, in all honesty, there's a woman who edits another publication out in Colorado called the Freeland Report, I think it's called. I think that as far as the park systems, over the last 4 to 8 years, they've tried to take bigger and bigger chunks out in Utah and Colorado, and there's been a lot of pushback from the states who believe they can do a much better job of the parks, so that they wouldn't stop being parks, but they would be better maintained because they'd be done by the states. Now, the other problem, again, with federal land is because of the politics in Washington, the leasing program, now the federal government receives money, revenue off of their leases for oil and gas. And because of the politics, they're supposed to have a decision, I think, within 90 days. And many of these requests are 3 or 4 years old, Jason. So what's really happening with the new administration is they're working on getting back on schedule. So if you make an application, and of course they can't go in there and just tear the place up. I mean, it has to be done environmentally friendly. But you will find out and be able to go forward looking for more natural gas and for oil.
You know,
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the thing that I've learned is, you know, take like these rig mats, for example. You know, they lay those things down, and the way those things operate is it doesn't take away the native flora, actually. So when they're done, the native flora grows back. And that's just one example. That's just one example of many that oil and gas has learned over the past, you know, decades and everything when it comes to reclamation. What I see as a huge potential for the federal government, and I'm curious if Zinke is going to explore this at all, which is, could you imagine if you figured out a way that whatever minerals came out of the national parks, that money went right back into the national parks? That would take care of the national parks for decades.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know the history of what Walt Stegner called America's greatest idea, and that is the national parks. They were created back in the 1870s, but they never received any funding for them. So it wasn't until the early 20th century that somebody, a guy by the name of Stephen Mather, figured out how to make the parks into more of an attraction for people to visit. And he literally spent his own money and paid staff for a couple of years to prove to the federal government that by using these more effectively and without, you know, trashing them, that they could pay for themselves. So, you know, the truth is, it's Washington is such a strange place. I don't even know where to start. As you know, I've been lobbying out here for almost 20 years, and sometimes I look under the hood and I think, boy, there's not much thinking going on here. And there's, you know, and it's more money than anything. But the truth is, there's a lot of money that they're leaving in the ground right now that could be that the federal government could lease out to responsible companies. And I've been out to one of your fracking sites out in the Black Hills, and I mean, somebody was trying. You know, I was talking to somebody here, somebody from Maryland, who, you know, when I talked about fracking, that looked like I was talking about the atomic bomb or something, you know. And I went on to explain, and I said, "Have you ever seen any of the operation?" No, I said, "You know, these cell towers have more presence in places like North Dakota than these fracking operations. And it's true. But see, no, the problem is, and I think you and I have talked about this, that one of the things that you and I have really kind of agreed to start thinking about and working on is we've got to get your story and the story of fracking and what it's done for North Dakota out in front of the people so that they begin to understand that this is not some kind of a disaster, fracking, but in fact, it's a great vehicle for economic development.
You know, if I might jump in here for just a second on that, because in fact, I just wrote this down today that fracking, you know, I've been doing a story on refracs. I interviewed Whiting Petroleum on refracs, Justin Kringler of North Dakota Pipeline Authority, Lynn Helm. So we're getting some nice, good, qualified interviews for this refrac feature that we've got coming up at the end of the year. Now, what I learned through that process was that spell check doesn't know that word, and it keeps wanting to call it referrals. And the same I had the same problem with fracking. And so that tells me the oil and gas industry yet once again is so far ahead of the curve that they're ahead of Webster's Dictionary, for crying out loud. And when you're ahead of the curve, people get scared. People get scared and they don't know how to react. And so I look at right now, fracking is going through a little bit of an education process. And I think as more people, as people get more educated, I think that it's going to become a lot more accepted when they realize there's a lot more fear mongering than there is results.
No, there's no question at all about that. As you know, I've been working with Jim Willis, who publishes the Marcellus Daily News, and in fact, he wants to do some work with us because he's having the same trouble in Pennsylvania. And of course, Pennsylvania is a much larger state and a very highly political state. So, you know, they're still, even though they're one of the largest producers, they are still sitting on an awful lot of property and natural gas that the politicians won't let them have access to. And only because of that fear. Now, one of the problems, and I liked your analogy about the dictionary, fracking sounds a little bit dirty, if I can just say that. So part of the reason why the environmental community started using fracking instead of, what's the official name?
It was hydraulic fracturing.
Hydraulic fracturing. So, in some ways, the environmental group was really playing, using that word against fracking.
Well, you know, it totally makes sense. I'll never forget. I was at Jackson Hole, Wyoming, for every year they do this great economic and energy and infrastructure summit, and and all the big. I mean, Federal Reserve people come in, a number of different things.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I'll. Yeah, and I'll never forget that I want to say the guy in charge of natural gas, in charge of the association for the country, and he said, "Boy, if we ticked off the best PR firm in the nation and gave them a ton of money and said, come up with a name that's going to bury our industry, they came up with fracking and we bought it." He goes, "That's the worst name possible that we could have came up with, yet it still seems to work." So,
well, see, we didn't, those of us who believe in the private sector and economic development, we didn't come up with that, but we're kind of stuck with it now, you know?
Well, it's one of those things where it really, you know, it was actually the correct term, and it was an abbreviated term, and then in my opinion, the protesters and some of the people who use the environment as a religion really painted the narrative ahead of the oil and gas industry, because the oil and gas industry was so focused on just the raw facts as opposed to the emotion.
Well, and I think they've been very busy, and of course, the decade in North Dakota, has been, what a remarkable decade you guys have. You know, you've gone from wildcatting to, really now being a very stable industry. You know so much more about it probably than any other region or any other basin. But one of the problems, and you and I have talked about this before, they haven't paid much attention to PR and good communication. And a good example of that is, while it's worthwhile talking about tight oil and natural gas, which is two of the byproducts of fracking, and in both cases, they've driven the price of oil and natural gas down at least 30%. But here's the other thing that's not being talked about, and it should be, and that is fracking's contribution to feedstock and the making of plastics that, you know, in some ways people think even plastics is swearing. Well, the truth is we wouldn't have sanitary water. There are all kinds of things we couldn't do and be sanitary without plastics in containers. I mean, just go to Africa sometime and, you know, you'd pray to have a bottle of water, you know, that's sealed. So, to me, I think North Dakota has to pick up and tell the last and a very important part of your story, and that is how important feedstock has been and is to the American and the world economy, and also that it's driven down the price of feedstock about the same that natural gas and tight oil has. So, I mean, it's a three-time winner. You know, think of anything else you can that has had such a profound impact on three enormous markets.
Professor Stephen Hines with us. He's out at the what was the name of the conference again?
It's called the NARUC, National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners.
Okay.
So your people are here. Chris Nelson from South Dakota is here, but they have the national meetings to sort of share ideas and work on solutions, and they also like using some states as a petri dish, you know, for experimentation and whether it will work good enough so that it can be applied by other states.
And I just want to correct you one second. South Dakota's there, but earlier when we talked, it was a North Dakota, of course, where the primary part of the Bakken was, and you mentioned Julie Fedorchuk was down there, North Dakota Public Service Commissioner. Give us a little bit of an update of what Julie Fedorchuk, North Dakota Public Service Commissioner, is doing down at the conference in Baltimore, Maryland.
That's a good question, because I went up, you know, I've met Julie now, four or five times, and I always go up and we talk a bit, but she's been headed a couple of panel discussions and on gas, unsurprisingly, but, you know, she's a real solid presence. She's smart. She's visible. I think she's in one of the senior officers of the national organization, but she has really done North Dakota proud.
How about in terms of maybe what she talked about? You know, you mentioned feedstock earlier. Of course, you know, North Dakota's got that wet gas. I mean, we've got pentane, butane, so many tanes that the Texas companies love it up here because it's not dry like their gas. Did she mention anything about the feedstock or the different types of gas?
You know, I think that part of our job really is to educate even the commissioners, which I have done with Julie. And, you know, I send you stuff, right, that I think are important for you and your viewership and your readership, et cetera, and your listenership. And I also send it to Julie. So one of the things she said to me, you know, I said, you know, boy, there's still a lot of education that needs to be done, even at the utility commissioners. And she said, yes, there is. And she said, keep up the good work. And then I mentioned your name, and I said, you and I started doing some work together. And she said, I know. And she said, I think it's great.
Well,
you know, but it's hard because more than half the states don't have any reservoirs of, natural gas, et cetera. It's like it's only, you know, part of the United States are even talking about it or even know about it. The rest are just reading the New York Times or the Washington Post or watching PBS. So, I mean, it's hard to make a national issue really in a forum like this, because it really, for some people, they don't care. I mean, some commissioners or some commissions don't care. Because what does it have to do with them? And which is kind of the way South Dakota feels right now, because they have so little participation in your, you know, your energy revolution. But when I talk to him, you know, I end up talking about telecommunication, which, you know, I know quite a bit about. But otherwise, I mean, as far as talking about, you know, natural gas and what's going on, I think that he's, you know, they're jealous in some ways. I mean, that's part of, I think, North Dakota's problem is a lot of states are prejudiced of what you guys are sitting on right now and what you've done.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I think they're what I always hear is that we always move too fast for a lot of other states. And we just like to say, well, we got a very good business environment here that we, you know, we go off of track records and we go off of a number of different things. And so anyway, but Stephen Hines here.
Everybody, you're a small state, so everybody knows everybody. Your governor's very personable and accessible. Here in Pennsylvania, I swear, you know, I mean, what is the population here? 12 or 13 million. But it is so, you know, politicized. So you have a group of people who have really been harvesting the Marcellus, but are being, you know, stopped almost every place they try and do something new, including in West Virginia, they're getting stopped by the environmentalists. And they are a very strong force here, and in numbers, and with money.
Well, it's
a very political state. I envy you, frankly. Is when my first trip to North Dakota, the first thing I thought was, "My God, you guys are, you know, you're living at a human scale where you can actually get things done, and you know people, and people like you can go ahead and have an interview with the governor." I promise you, there aren't many people in other states to have that luxury.
Professor Stephen Hines with us. Just a few more minutes left with the good professor down in Baltimore, Maryland, checking out on some political and infrastructure and natural gas, energy talk, you name it. Just kind of winding down here, just go ahead and kind of summarize what you have seen either from the national trend or the shale plays. Just kind of what are people talking about down there?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, it's more on people's minds that they have different committees. So they have a committee that covers gas, and along with electricity and environmental. But in this panel, in the four sessions they had, it was absolutely full. There were 25 or 30 people at the back of the room stand. And we're talking about a conference that has 1,500 people. So I think, you know, it is becoming more and more and more visible. I think that it really amounts to one simple thing, that the oil and gas industry, as it is, has got to start doing a better job of communicating what they're doing. Now, your state does a damn good job, but a lot of states don't. They have to stop just, you know, doing the work. They have to figure out that this is a political question, too. And they cannot ignore the politics. And if they do, it will be at their own risk.
For more information on Professor Stephen Hines, the Word Merchant, visit our website, thecrudelife.com, for his contact information. That's our website, thecrudelife.com, for links to Professor Stephen Hines' contact information. And that was Professor Stephen Hines with The Weekly Word.